This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Well, hi there. I'm Joe Kroller, and it is my distinct pleasure to introduce my guest today, which is Robert McCrum. And Robert has a long career as an editorial director and then chief editor of Faber & Faber, literary editor, and then associate editor of The Observer, writer of dozens of books, and now this one, which we'll talk about today, Shakespearean, on life and language in times of disruption. And Robert, I have one really great question for you to start this off.
Sure. It's a pleasure to be on your podcast, and thank you so much for making this happen.
Thank you. What drove you to Bardology?
I think it was a series of happy accidents, really. Bardology implies that I'm obsessed with the character, which isn't really the case. I'm not obsessed by his character or his personality, really. But I think, like many English schoolboys, I performed in Shakespeare at school. I was in King Lear. I was in Midsummer Night's Dream. But it wasn't, and Shakespeare is part of the wallpaper of our culture. But it wasn't until I was really in my 40s that Shakespeare clicked for me, and that I was recovering from a very serious illness. I had a stroke when I was 42, and I was very badly paralyzed, pretty much all over, apart from my right side. And all that worked was my right arm and hand and leg. So I could lie in bed pretty much immobilized. And the only things I could hold in one hand, because my left side was not working. Now it's now working fine, but it wasn't then, were play scripts. So I would lie in bed and read Shakespeare plays. And I'd read, favorite passages, and then I would discover new Shakespeare plays which I hadn't read before. And then one thing led to another. And then when I recovered fully, I would go and see plays with some friends who are described in the book as the Shakespeare Club, which, when I say happy accident, that was also a group of my college associates who formed this group very informally and kind of casually, where we just went to see if new productions of Shakespeare, which you can do in London any day of the week. There's always a new production. There's a new Macbeth at the moment, just opened. So at any one time, there'd be seven or eight of us going off to see a new Shakespeare play, and then we would discuss it and talk about it. And then one thing led to another. And then this book actually happened. I was inspired to do it in America when I was over in New York in June of 2017, shortly after the Trump presidency began. And there was a production of Shakespeare in the Park, Julius Caesar, in the Delacorte Theatre. And I went along with my now friend and ally, Jim Shapiro, the great Shakespeare scholar. And he took me along to see this show. And it was Julius Caesar. And we sat in the front row. And the Oscar Eustace, the director of the show, great director, had cast Shakespeare as Trump. So he was blonde wig, red tie, white shirt. And every night in the production caused quite a stir, actually, because every night in the middle, he was assassinated very bloodily on stage in front of 3,000 New Yorkers. And this did not go down well on the right and amongst Trump supporters. And there was quite a stink led by Fox News, of course. And halfway through this show, we both turned to each other and said, "Isn't it extraordinary? This play, which is more than 400 years old, is speaking to this audience as though for the first time." And something clicked in my head, and I said, I want to explore why it is that Shakespeare is so modern, why he can seem like a contemporary, even though it was 400 years old. He's an Elizabethan Englishman. He speaks to any audience, and the book is really that's the latest accident. The book is really an examination of that question.
Well, that is an excellent example for me, mostly because I'm a historian, and I noted that you're watching Caesar, and then we dress Caesar up like Trump, and it's like, my God, history is repeating itself here. And I'm reading in your book, I get to a point where you're talking about that Shakespeare as a writer really began with history for his plays, Richard III, Henry VI, King John. But what I find interesting is when he writes this history in play form, he inserts the common folks. It's a couple of quotes, "Let's kill all the lawyers," or "It was never a merry world in England since gentlemen came up." I wonder if you could speak to that.
Well, I think that's a very good point, because it is the key to his, he was always putting his plays on in the playhouse in front of ordinary people. The playhouse in Elizabethan times, it was the movie house, it was Hollywood, it was the only entertainment in town, and everyone went. And in London, something like 15%, estimates, of course. London was a city in those days of probably 2 or 3 million, not very many. And 15%, it has been calculated, thereabouts, would go to the playhouse on a very regular basis, as I say, like going to see the movies. And so, have you been to the Globe in London, the Globe Theatre in London?
I have, yes.
You have. So you know what, an open-air theatre with an apron stage surrounded by the audience in the pit, as it's called. And you will remember from your visit there how the audience surrounds the cart. The cart is in the middle of the audience. And Shakespeare, I think, never underestimated the importance of appealing to the audience in front of him. It's not recorded. It's completely live. It's happening in the moment. And the joy of Shakespeare, I think, is that it always happens in the moment.
I think you called it raucous, bawdy, and extremely popular. So I was wondering how that space, the Globe Theater, directed Shakespeare's writings.
Well, I think, first of all, he has in mind that he wants to grab the audience's attention from the beginning. There's no mucking around here. There's no preamble. There might be a prologue, but once you've got past the prologue, say the prologue at the beginning of Romeo and Juliet, there'll be a fight on stage. In the case of Macbeth, the curtain didn't go. There was no curtain. They would start, and there would be three witches. When shall we three meet again, in thunder, lightning, or in rain? So that's very, very, very bold, a theatrical maneuver, having three witches in an age which believed in witchcraft on stage in front of the audience. Or in the case of Hamlet, a ghost. He never flinched from grabbing the audience by the scruff of the neck and holding onto them all the way through, as long as, he wanted to have their attention. And it was, as I said, as you quoted, it's bawdy, it's raucous, it's if you've seen a Shakespeare play at the Globe, you'll know it's quite sort of rough and ready in many respects. It's not like a theatre with a proscenium arch and the lights going down, the curtain coming, all that kind of thing. It's very open, very democratic. And I think the key to Shakespeare is that he grew up in a small country town far from the city, and he grew up in a community, and as it were, an open-air country community. And he never underestimated or patronized his audience.
I love this one quote, speaking to that, because he's Stratford-on-Avon, and that the language in his plays was basically a mashup of Stratford and Shoreditch, Bling versus Barnyard kind of thing. And maybe that's why we get this common culture, this common man and woman in a mix of high and low culture. And you said this is the stirring of a mass society about him. And I'm just wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
The stirring of a what society?
A mass society, a mass culture consumption.
Yes, it is the first time in England, I don't know elsewhere, but certainly in England, it's the first time the common people were going to see this kind of entertainment. Now, it's obviously it was for them popular entertainment. It's also, as we now know, in many cases, high art. And you know, he would mix the entertainment of the ghosts and the witches with wonderful speeches. And he also, in the case of Hamlet, affected what you might call a theatrical revolution, which was the idea of self-consciousness, the self-conscious actor expressing his opinion, in this case, his opinions, directly to the audience. So when Hamlet, at the beginning of Hamlet, steps to the front of the stage and speaks to the audience about his anxieties, his doubts and fears about committing suicide, famous line, to be or not to be, that is the question. That was a revolution. That had never happened before. The actor taking the audience into his confidence to express his self-conscious anxieties about himself.
Would you think that would be a Stratford thing or a London thing?
I think it's probably more of a London. I mean, I think it was something which, and Shakespeare took 10 years to get to the point where Hamlet walks to the front of the stage and gives that speech. Took 10 years of theatrical development. And I think the other point to make about him, as well as being a country boy, I don't want to think he's making him sound like a rustic yokel, but he was from the provinces. He worked with a group of actors called the Lord Chamberlain's Men. They ended up being called the King's Men because their patron became king. And they were like, you know, they were like a theatrical troupe. They were like Monty Python. They worked together. They performed together. He wrote the plays. They performed them, and everything evolved in the community of the theatrical group. It's very democratic. And I think he was somebody who was used to. They would say, "Come on, Will, we need a speech here, or we need something." And they would, as it were, workshop the plays in performance. And so they would evolve as a kind of collaboration between the actors and Shakespeare and indeed the audience.
Thank you. Let me switch gears here for a second. You mentioned Shakespeare goes from the country to London 1590s, somewhere in there. And London at that time is a mix of Puritans and a lot of danger. You described his arrival at Bishop's Gate. And I'm wondering how that arrival kind of shaped Shakespeare.
Well, I think, you know, to come to London from a market town like Stratford would have been an extraordinary experience. I mean, what we still call the City of London, which is the medieval city in the middle of London, it's now the financial district. It's a tiny area. It's you could walk across it in 5 minutes, and it was teeming with many different nationalities, many different kinds of people. It had several playhouses cheek by jowl. There were four or five, all really close together, and it bordered the Thames, which was a thoroughfare. It was a way of traveling about the place. It was very exciting. It was dangerous. There were fights. There was plague. those street disturbances, and there was live performance, live entertainment. So it was very vivid, I think. And to a young boy who'd been used to, as I say, the market town, which is very peaceful, it would have been an extraordinary experience.
I keep getting this dichotomy between, in your book, you point out that the streets of London at that time is quite dangerous. Punch-ups, sword fights, stabbings, roguish vocabulary. But then you had the opposite. You had Puritans roaming about trying to keep a lid on it all. I just keep trying to imagine Shakespeare drinking that all in.
Well, if you want to see where he lived, it is still possible. There's a church in Bishopsgate, which is a neighborhood in the city, called St. Helen's Church. It's open to the public. You can walk in there, and when you walk in there, it's like stepping back into the 15th century. It's completely unchanged, and you can imagine him being there. And he had lodgings very nearby. There's now a big financial. There's a bank where his house was, but
a bank in London. No. okay, so he arrives. He starts writing. He's going to meet other playwrights: Watson, Peel, Kidd, Nash.
That's right. Sure.
Green, yep. Marlowe. I keep looking at this and I'm going, competition. How did that drive Will Shakespeare? Did he have something other driving him other than the competition?
I think all writers are competitive. You know, so one writer will do one thing and others will then be inspired to compete with that. That happens all the time. And his great rival and competitor, we can never put them in the room together. We never know whether they actually spoke. I think they must have done, because they work for the same theatre group. It was Christopher Marlowe and Will and Kit. Were great. I think they weren't great friends, but they certainly knew each other, and they must have met, and they must have talked, and they would spar off each other. So Marlowe would write Edward II, Shakespeare would write Richard II, Marlowe would write Jew of Malta, Shakespeare would write The Merchant of Venice. They echo and they follow each other. So it's competitive. I think it was a friendly. With some of the other playwrights, it became quite bitter. So Ben Jonson and Shakespeare were not great friends. No one really liked Ben Jonson. He was very difficult to work with, very prickly. But it was exceedingly, and they're all very young. They're all in their 20s and 30s. And by the time Shakespeare is 40, this is the extraordinary thing. By the time he was 40, all his younger contemporaries, they're all dead. They'd either died from plague or fighting or one thing or various kinds of illness, and he stood alone, and he'd survived. But there were about 15 of them, and many of them had collaborated in his early years. They did collaborate together.
Well, I'm looking at that word that you just brought up, plague. You make mention of it a couple of times in a couple of places in the book, and. Basically, from 1592 to 1603, London's going to lose about a quarter of its population. I mean, death is just everywhere. This had to have sunk in on Will Shakespeare.
Mm. And, you know, while I was finishing this book, of course, we had our own version of the plague with COVID. But and a number of people wanted to draw parallels between then and now. But I'm afraid to say that our plague is nothing compared to the bubonic. The bubonic plague was terrifying. If you got one of the symptoms, you know, if you got a pustule on your arm or your hand, you knew that within 24 hours, not more, you would die the most horrible, excruciating death. It was a dreadful way to go, and it as you rightly say, it decimated the population. And the extraordinary thing is, given how much plague there was during his early, about roughly half his first decade of working in London was affected by plague. It's surprising how few references. I think people just took the plague for granted. There are surprisingly few references to it. It was just part of the condition of being in London, I think.
I'm going to thank you. I'm going to shift the story here just a little bit, because as a historian, whenever I get to talk about England during Will Shakespeare's time, when I get to talk about Queen Elizabeth, when I get to talk about the James I, I often take a look at, well, Shakespeare's and his gender and his role in writing women roles. And I'm looking at his treatment with the Merry Wives of Windsor, Taming of the Shrew, Lady Macbeth. She's just so dominant in that play. And then, of course, there's Queen Elizabeth's treatment of the Earl of Essex, which later on. And I'm wondering if you think, as I think this, that Shakespeare held women in a much higher esteem than English culture at that time allowed. And I'm wondering if you think that's true or not.
Well, I certainly think, I mean, what you've got to recognize that not all your listeners will remember this, but women on the stage in Elizabethan England were played by boys. Women didn't appear on stage. If you remember the play, the film Shakespeare in Love, the part of it turns on the revelation that Viola de Lesseps, is actually she's pretending to be a boy in order to get on stage. Women didn't play roles, and it's clear that Shakespeare was able to draw on three or four very talented boy actors to play these women's parts. I think the thing about Shakespeare is he's got tremendous, and this is one of his great characters, one of the reasons why he appeals to us so strongly, tremendous humanity, which shows itself again and again. I mean, you mentioned Lady Macbeth, who is a dark, psychotic, you know, she's an evil woman, but she's also portrayed with tremendous sympathy, and so that when in the end she goes mad and is sleepwalking and Macbeth has been reduced to having to his whole assault on power has crumbled in his hands, and he's facing the ruin of his plans. It's very, that part of the play is a very moving moment, and he makes the famous speech, "Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day." That's a speech of a psychopath and killer and tyrant who is strangely human. And Lady Macbeth also, although she said she wants to unsex herself in front of the audience, is also strangely human. And his great genius was to get inside the hearts and minds of, as it were, dreadful people.
you brought up a point that I think is important here, that the role of women were played by boys or men.
Teenage boys.
And I'm wondering, you mentioned in a couple of places Shakespeare's alleged bisexuality. And I'm wondering, is this really important for us to know?
Well, my feeling about all of these questions about the relationship between the man and his work, the life and the art, so to speak, is that if he writes a bunch of sonnets, which he did write, which express homosexual, heterosexual, and bisexual, you know, all kinds of love from various different points of view, we have to pay attention to that. Whether that's him or whether it's just his imagination, who knows? We just don't know, but he's playing with this, and I think we have to respond to that. So it does matter, because you know it's Shakespeare, and these are his words. But it is a bit of a rat. You can go down that rabbit hole, and there are plenty of people who say he was gay. There are others who say he's bisexual. You know, there are different ways of reading this, and who knows?
I think maybe it's just a kind of a story with people who are thespians or in theater production. Maybe that's just a strand that a continuity from those times to now, I suppose. I want to get to a point where we get to the coronation of James the First.
Right. Yeah. Which is, if I may interrupt.
Yes.
It's very easy. So let's not lose sight of the coronation of James the First. But let's just also say that Shakespeare's career falls in, it's a game of two halves. The 1590s, the first half, and the 1600s, the second half. And the first half, as you rightly pointed out earlier on, was his patron was Elizabeth I, this titanic figure. And the second half, his patron was James I, also a very powerful figure in many ways, but quite different, Scottish. And so those two halves are side by side, and the one follows the other. But so the coronation of James comes as a kind of halfway point in his career, very interestingly.
Yeah, thank you. I'm just so fascinated by this because, again, we're, again, very different monarch from a very different place. And I'm kind of hoping you can set the scene for me because there's two plays that come right after James I takes the throne. And the first of which is King Lear. And the other one is, I think, even more dangerous, which is Macbeth. But I really, really want to talk about King Lear because this is an old king going mad and he has three daughters.
Yes. But let's start. Can I start with Macbeth? If you want to understand Shakespeare's creative audacity, Macbeth is the place to start.
Absolutely. Yes.
Just imagine his patron, the Queen, has died, and there's a new king who speaks Scottish, hard to understand for a Londoner, who's come down from Edinburgh from the north. He's arrived in Hampton Court. He's set up his new court. No one knows a thing about him, but he is the Lord Chamberlain's man. He's their new patron, and he's so pleased to be the new patron. They're renamed. They're called the King's Men. They're kitted out in scarlet livery, very special, and they become part of the royal court. And it falls to them to produce entertainment for the new king. And so, and this is where the extraordinary audacity of Shakespeare comes into play. So what does Shakespeare do? He finds a Scottish... So first of all, he's going to find a Scottish story for the new king. But he doesn't know much about the king. All he knows is... Or in fact, no one knows much about James, but they know that he has a traumatic fear of assassination. His mother had been killed by, was executed by Queen Elizabeth, and he'd witnessed assaults on his mother and bloody murders in her household. So he's terrified of assassination. He's obsessed as a new king of the country that became Britain, with the unity of the kingdom. And thirdly, the only other thing that anyone really knew about James was he was also obsessed with witches. The other thing that anyone knew about James was he'd written a pamphlet called Demonology, which was a pamphlet about witchcraft. So what does Shakespeare do? He writes a play in which a king is horribly assassinated, which explores the division of the kingdom and which has witchcraft all the way through it. I mean, it's the most outrageous challenge to a new audience imaginable. Of course, the king loved it. He loved to be entertained. He lapped it up, and they remained. The King's Men remained popular with him for the rest of Shakespeare's working life. But I think it's very important to see that he would always go to the point of maximum jeopardy in his work, vis-a-vis the audience. He was not afraid to take a very big risk. But moving on to King Lear, which Lear is one of the great pinnacles of English theatre. Samuel Johnson said that he was the great lexicographer, said that it was a play you couldn't be performed, it could only be read. It was just too grand, too magnificent, too bleak to be put on stage. I mean, I think that's not true, actually. I've seen many great productions of Lear. But it's a very difficult play. It's a very dark play. And it's, well, going back to where we began, we're talking about his modern spirit. Parts of it could have been written by Samuel Beckett.
I'm sorry, I suddenly got an image of you lying in bed, recovering, reading King Lear.
King Lear.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's got some marvelous poetry. I mean, I was actually in it when I played Gloucester when I was at school. And at one point, I knew the whole play by heart because you do if you're in a show. I mean, I've got quite a good memory, And I used to, I can't anymore. I've lost it, but I could recite chunks of it from memory. And some of the poetry in Lear is very, very beautiful, or very moving. Because although the old king is mad as a hatter, his madness is tragic, and it's going back to the present. You know, we're, as the population ages, we're very concerned about dementia and those kind of issues. And there's something which is very, in some ways, I don't think Shakespeare is what you might call a topical playwright, but he does address many of the great themes of everyday life.
So I'm looking at this gunpowder plot in 1605, where, you know, the famous Guy Fawkes. And
it's worth just saying, it's a plot which never happened.
I mean, this is true. Know, absolutely
it's,
true.
It's a great threat to the English state, which never happened. And it's a classic English non-event.
but because of that event that didn't happen, we get what you write, England fell into conspiracy theory.
Absolutely.
And that is so 21st century right now.
Sure. No, and they hunted down the plotters, and they hunted them down and then executed them in the most horrible way. If it had happened, if the gunpowder had gone off, the court would have been blown sky high in one conflagration. It would have destroyed the entire infrastructure with the strike of one match. But anyway, it didn't happen, and so there we are. But he refers to thought in Lear. He refers to thought executing fires. It's a famous speech, and the thought executing fires of Lear, the thought executing fires of the gunpowder plot. And that's an example of the way in which Shakespeare never fails to, you know, he's also a mirror of his times. And you find these references scattered through the plays all the way through. You can track his engagement with everyday life in those kind of allusions.
I'm just so enraptured by this. I guess it's because I'm a historian. That Shakespeare finds himself inadvertently at such personal risk because of the gunpowder plot, because of his plays. I mean, he's just playing on the fears of the monarch. And I'm just beside myself with how much risk he actually took.
He would have been, at certain points, he was very close to the edge. And you mentioned earlier on the rebellion of the Earl of Essex,
yes.
which was a sort of a coup attempt against Elizabeth I. Didn't happen again. Another failed plot. But part of that coup attempt was a production of a Shakespeare play to Richard II, designed to rouse up the ordinary people. And at that point, the Lord Chamberlain's men were in real jeopardy. Because the state was not benign towards attempts to bring it down, and they came very close to having a very rough time, and they didn't. I think the Queen would have intervened. She said, "These are foolish players getting involved way over their heads." But it would have been a very, very nervous. But when they were summoned, some of them were summoned to the Star Chamber to be interrogated by the authorities, and that would have been a terrifying moment.
Must have been.
And you know, Shakespeare was at court. He was close to power. Power is a dangerous. It's a very dangerous game. And in those days, you could lose your head very easily.
That's why I really love the subtitle of your book, and I'm going to repeat it here: "Life and Language in Times of Disruption." And I think that's just wonderful. So great title.
Thank you. Nowadays, books have to have some. I quite like the title Shakespearean, but the publishers they wanted a subtitle. That was the subtitle we came up with, because you get more tracking on Google if you have subtitles. Yeah, I'm not kidding.
Yes. All right. So we've been spending a lot of time on his plays, and I want to shift over to his sonnets. They're not as familiar to me as his plays, but you do describe his use of sonnets as a way for Will Shakespeare to have some fun, in a way, a preference for his quote-unquote visible invisibility. what does that even mean?
Well, I think the thing about him is, you know, he hides in plain sight. He will always draw on his life and experience, and I think his personality is in some ways expressed through that. But at the same time, he's completely opaque. We never really know what he's thinking because he thinks, you know, he'll present a point of view from so many different perspectives. We can never say, aha, he's a Republican. Aha, he's a revolutionary. You can read Coriolanus in lots of different ways. We began with Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar can be a play about a tyrant, can be a play about the dangers of Republican revolutionary activity. There are lots of different readings. And I've described elsewhere, what I call his negligent ambiguity. He likes to be ambiguous. He likes to be slippery. He doesn't want to be pinned down. Dangerous to be pinned down. And he's always quite evasive. And I think that's very much in character.
It's pretty amazing to me when I study English history, and which I do, by the way, if you write and you publish, you put yourself in danger. That's true with Thomas Hobbes. It's true with many, many writers in the past. Yeah. I'm wondering how Shakespeare has this illustrious career and is able to escape all of this.
Well, I think it's a mark of Elizabeth I's intelligence, and she was a formidably bright woman, that she recognized that in her court she had this writer of tremendous gifts. And I think he was given a kind of license. I think the rules didn't apply to him in the way that they applied to others, and he was allowed to get away with it. And, you know, he was the jewel in her crown. And if you take a play like Midsummer Night's Dream, there are many references to the imperial votaress, and he refers to the queen in that in very lavish and supportive terms. He never failed to flatter his audience, his queen.
So you think the queen honestly knew that William Shakespeare was this jewel?
I think so. I think so, yeah. And you mentioned the sonnets. The sonnets are Shakespeare, as it were, Shakespeare at home. They were very private. They circulated privately. They weren't printed until 1609, so quite late on. He didn't ever gather them together into a single volume until quite late. But, and here's a clue as to how he thought about his work, the sonnets were produced in a very lovely edition, and it is clear that he took some trouble in the making of the printing of that edition. Whereas the play scripts are often very rough and ready and full of errors and so forth. The sonnets are beautifully presented. And I think for him, if you'd asked him, are you a playwright first or a poet first, he'd say, I'm a poet who writes plays. But the poetry is the thing that really matters to him. I think in many ways more than the plays. But who knows?
Yeah. So going back to Queen Elizabeth then, she has a very famous event. Her former lover, Earl of Essex, is now executed, and she's the one that orders it. And from this, or after this, we get Hamlet. And you write that Hamlet is this different kind of theatrical hero. So how so?
Well, he is the first Shakespeare character to put what you might call inwardness, interior thoughts, private thoughts, on stage in front. He presents his inner musings to the audience in the most brilliant, you know, Hamlet, the first half of Hamlet has three or four great soliloquies. Oh, that this too solid flesh should melt, to be or not to be, those kind of speeches. And that was a revolution. That hadn't happened before. And you can always tell with Shakespeare when he really minds about what he's, as it were, on message. He doesn't have great big speeches. He has these brilliant lines in very basic English that anyone can understand. So to be or not to be, that is the question, is a very stark statement. It's designed to get the audience in the pit paying attention. And there are countless examples all the way through all the plays of his ability to, as it were, nail a theme in one line. I mean, I'm thinking of Henry IV, Part 2, when what you might call the fall of Falstaff at the very end, when Falstaff comes back to London. Prince Hal has become King Henry V, and Falstaff and his posse come back to London, and they think they're going to become part of the court, and it's all going to be sided with, you know, a good time for all concerned. And they stand in the street waiting for the king to pass and to buttonhole their old buddy. And Falstaff calls out to his old mate, Prince Hal, and this is the line. King Henry V looks at Falstaff and says, "I know thee not, old man, fall to thy prayers. I know thee not, old man." Again, plain, old-fashioned English, nothing fancy. And when Shakespeare wants to signal, as it were, a gear change or a plot change or a character change in his plays, he'll always use the simplest language. It's very, and doesn't have big speeches, although he's a master of a big speech. He knows it's far more effective to have one good line, which is actually something any writer can learn from.
I'm going to kind of follow up with, you mentioned the Earl of Southampton, Shakespeare's patron.
Yeah, and maybe lover. Who knows? If he was gay, was he? Who knows? We don't know.
Who knows? But I find that patronage fascinating in the sense that there's a number of times that the theaters are just shut down in London. And, you know, a good chunk of his career, theater is shut down in London. And so I'm wondering how close was he to Southampton?
Well, I mean, Southampton was incredibly wealthy, and he had this kind of his own, as it were, private court. He had his own estates, and crucially, he had property away from London. So when the plague struck London and threatened to decimate the population, Shakespeare could retire to the country and be quite safe. And there are parallels with our own recent experience there. He would go into the sticks to be safe and to be in the company of the Earl of Southampton. What their relationship actually was, we don't know. But he was his patron, and the sonnets were, as it were, the fruit of their relationship in a strange way.
Would it be that the Earl of Southampton was one of the reasons why Shakespeare kind of was able to avoid any repercussions when the Earl of Essex went down?
Maybe it's so, you know, we know so little about the. Earl of Southampton was actually imprisoned as a result of because he was part of Essex's group, and so when Essex fell, Southampton was imprisoned for a bit, and then was released. Again, I think the Queen was, you know, very. Queen Elizabeth was very humane in many ways. He could have been executed. He wasn't. Similarly, Shakespeare's players could have been put in prison. They weren't. So clearly, there was some kind of understanding that these were remarkable individuals who deserved a special treatment.
Well, Robert, I've been reading this book and have been just glued to it. And I'm wondering,
thank you.
Yeah, how long did it? Did this book manifest itself into a creation where you were happy to put it off and send it to a publisher?
Well, it began, as I say, in my mind. I began to think about writing it in the summer of 2017. I didn't start to write it until 2018, and then I finished it. I'm just turning to the back here. I've lost track of time. The thing about COVID is we've all lost track of where we are in time, haven't we? I'm just turning to the back here, final pages. I've got the dates at the very end. I've never done this before. I just wanted to mark. Yes, I began to write it in October 2017. So I saw the Julius Caesar production in June with Jim Shapiro, and I spent the summer thinking about it. I began to write it. The title Shakespearean came to me very early on. And then I finished it in November 2019, just before the pandemic began. And then I have a postscript where I describe how the plague, you know, there were so many parallels between then and now, but the thing that was missing when I was writing, there was no plague. And then when I was copy editing and producing the final version between November 2019 and March 2020. Then Plague, I was able to put in a few references to Plague into the book, rather after the fact, but I wanted to put them in just to mark. So the book is, marks a strange moment in our lives. But I think we'll always look back on this time as a kind of hallucination in some ways.
I think we are living in Shakespearean time, so the title is
That's what I wanted to say. I mean, I think there are lots of similarities.
Did you enjoy the process? I guess is my next question.
It's a pleasure to be in his company, and I've speak about it at festivals, and I always challenge the audience, and I challenge you, Joe, to go home. When you get back to your desk, take down your Shakespeare, your collected Shakespeare. I'm assuming you've got several editions. Take down your collected Shakespeare, open it at any page at random, any double page spread at random, and read two pages, and you'll find something remarkable, a phrase, a characterization, an image, a thought. You know, he's infinitely appealing. You can go back and back to him anytime. And so I had this 3-year sort of idyll, really, of being alone in my flat, writing the book, having the works to hand, and having a really good time.
Well, I know you mentioned it before, Robert, and I think people who listen to the New Books Network will want to know, how are you? You've recovered, but how are you?
I'm pretty good. I mean, I can't play tennis or squash, or I can't run a mile. But I have a good life, and I can do all the things I want to do, and I feel well. And one thing I do is I swim. I swim a lot, and so this book was not quite significantly written in underwater, because I sort things out in my mind. When I'm swimming, I sort things out, the things that I can't figure out on paper, I work out in the pool.
Are there things that you learned about yourself when you were all done with this book?
I'm sure there are things. But it's too soon to say what they are. But it was like a moment of self-education, and it's sharpened up my sense of how the English language works on the page, I think.
Yes, that's true, and it works in so many varied ways. Go ahead.
I was going to say that obviously. When you write about Shakespeare, you're very aware that you're writing. It's like entering a vast cathedral of achievement. I mean, it's just a massive structure, and the people you encounter in the shadows of the cathedral are not only Shakespeare himself, but these great writers, Keats, Coleridge, Wordsworth, Johnson, Alexander Pope. A whole range of English giants and American giants too. And it makes you very humble when you encounter this grandeur.
You bring up something that is, I think, universal to many writers, including myself. Was when I wrote my book, I was first kind of naive, but as time went on, I found myself drawn. My book is in the 18th century, but I found myself so drawn to the 18th century and more and more research and going and going and I get a feel for what life must have been like at that moment. And I'm trying to, do you have a better feel now for the late 1590s and the early 17th century than you did before your book?
Yeah, I can also, I want to make one point, which is that his life, the hinge of the turn of the century between 1590 and 1600s, the 1600s, it's a great moment of change in English and European life. When you go back into his childhood and early years, you're in a world of superstition, sorcery, witchcraft, horrible violence. It's a really primitive world, and there's no medicine. There's no proper economy. There's no capitalism really. There's no medicine. There's very little law. It's wild. It's savage. It's very, very. It's kind of unknowable, and also enthralling. But when you turn the page into the 1600s, you've got James. Suddenly, it becomes. You can imagine stepping into a room with James, and the furniture is the same. The windows have glass. The houses still exist. There are very few Tudor buildings left, but there are lots of Jacobean buildings. And if you look at a Jacobean portrait, and the setting of a Jacobean portrait, it's a world which is sort of semi-familiar, and so the modern world begins in the second half of Shakespeare's career. But the first half, you're in a very primitive place. It's very dark, very strange. So, but I find that the juxtaposition of the medieval and the modern very appealing.
As do I. And you've given me something to think about, that turn of the century, from the 16th to the 17th century.
It's a real shift.
Massive, and we get America mentioned in one of Shakespeare's plays.
Yeah.
You wish to remind the audience about that?
Well, I think the extraordinary thing about Shakespeare's afterlife, and let's take his, let's remind ourselves that he died in 1616. The first folio was the first collection of his work was published the same time as the Pilgrim Fathers arrived in, roughly speaking, the Pilgrim Fathers arrived in Plymouth, Massachusetts, 1620, don't they? And the first folio was published in 1623. So America and Shakespeare's work are contemporaneous. And I think there's a very strong case for saying it's America, more than Britain actually, which makes his afterlife. I mean, your founding fathers, Jefferson, Adams, and so forth, were even Washington, were great Shakespeare. They would, and we know Lincoln used to wander about the White House reciting Shakespeare. The American political class have had a fascination with Shakespeare from the very beginning, and I think they played a very important role in popularizing Shakespeare for America. And there's a famous quote from the French writer Alexis de Tocqueville. In the 1830s, when he's traveling around America, and he notes that in every cabin in America, every log cabin, you always find a Shakespeare play or a collection of Shakespeare's lines. And I think there are many that wouldn't have been true in England. There's something about Shakespeare in American life which has kept him going and has popularized him. It's a very mysterious process, but I think strangely, America has been crucial in the, as I say, in his afterlife.
Yeah, I think in America we would put Shakespeare right next to the Bible.
yeah, indeed.
This is Joe Crowder, and I'm talking with Robert McCrum about his book, Shakespearean, on Life and Language in Times of Disruption. You're listening to the New Books Network, and we're just about done. Robert, what's next for you?
It's the question every writer dreads, and if I knew, I probably wouldn't tell you. So, but the short answer is I have no idea. I always feel, and this is not an original thought. Someone else said this, but when you write a book, you drain the well. You really drain everything out, and you empty yourself completely. And this was a very draining experience, and the well is now empty, and it has to fill up again. And it'll take a few months or years for that to happen. And when that's finished, when that process is over, there'll be another one. But for the moment, I'm very happy in the bottom of my well, and there's no water in it. That's all I can say, really. Who knows? Books come from all. When I went to see the Shakespeare in the Park in 2017, I had no idea this book would be the fruit of it. But not only did I write a book about experience, but so did Shapiro, and he wrote a book called Shakespeare in a Divided America, which is a terrific book. It came out earlier this year, or last year, I think. So there we were, sitting side by side, watching the show, and then from that came these two books, and I'm very happy to have done mine. I can't tell you what a pleasure it was to write it.
It was a pleasure to read. And as a historian, I got to tell you that, folks, we may be living in Shakespearean times, but this too shall pass. And I really thank you for this interview. It's been wonderful to talk to you.
Oh, thank you, Joe. I'm very appreciative. And I'm glad we managed to overcome the technological glitches to get to this point.